כל אשר עושה אלוקים למשה לישראל עמו.
Now, the simple interpretation of the pasuk doesn't seem to be too difficult, because how would we say Vayishma Yisro, and Yisro heard everything that God did for Moshe and Israel? What did he do? That he took him out of Egypt. In other words, the Vayishma, according to the simple pshat, relates to the end of the pasuk, Ki Hotzi Hashem es Yisro Mitzrayim. Rashi doesn't learn that way. Rashi learns that first is Vayishma Yisro. It's as if the Vayishma Yisro goes on what it said before. Now it's in the last week's parsha. What did he hear? That Hashem told Yoshua to fight Amalek, Vayishma Yisro. And that's what Yisro heard. So says Rashi, Mashmu Shoma Uvo, what made him come, says Rashi? Kriya Siyamsuf Umilchemes Amalek. What made him come was Kriya Siyamsuf Umilchemes Amalek. Now, really, Rashi goes on later on in the third Rashi where it says Eskol Asher Oso. Rashi learns that Eskol Asher Oso, everything that God did to Moshe and to Israel, that's something else that he also heard. What? Yirida Samon, he gave them food. Be'er, he gave them water. Amalek, again Amalek. So Rashi seems to differentiate what made him come, right? And what he heard that did not make him come. Okay? Now, what he heard was Yirida Samon, Be'er, Amalek, and Ki Hotzi Hashem, says Rashi, Zug Doyle Al Kulam. He heard everything. So what made him come? Kriya Siyamsuf and Milchemes Amalek. So now, of course, the Mephoshim ask, doesn't make any sense. I mean, if he heard everything, so why is it that what made him come was Kriya Siyamsuf and Milchemes Amalek? What's special about Kriya Siyamsuf and Milchemes Amalek? So, many of the Mephoshim say like this. Kriya Siyamsuf is Milchemes Amalek really is a question, an open question on Kriya Siyamsuf. Why? Because it says in the Shiro by Kriya Siyamsuf, it says like this. Oz Nivhalu Alufei Edom Eilei Moyov Road, no. In other words, all the important nations at the time were so overwhelmed by the story of the crossing of the Red Sea that they were shaking. It was such an incredible experience that it made a tremendous impact in the minds of Canaanites, Moabites, Yoshua Ploshes, right? The question is, what about Amalek? Why wasn't Amalek overwhelmed with the crossing of the Red Sea like everybody else was? So, we must answer that it's possible to reach such a level of insensitivity, right? That if you are so low, you become so insensitive, that it's possible that something that should make a tremendous impact won't make on you any impact at all. So Amalek is a warning on anyone who says to himself, you know what, I'll stay at home, right? I won't join the Jewish people. I'll stay at home and I'll be good and I'll just admire the Jewish people from far, but I won't do any harm to anybody because I'm a good person. Amalek shows that that's impossible. You can never be sure because you may lose your complete sensitivity if you become so involved with physical matters. Now, we know that Amalek represents Esav, right? Amalek is the evil side of Esav. That's what Amalek is, the grandson of Esav. What is the evil side of Esav? The complete involvement in the immediate pleasures. Remember, we once spoke about Esav choosing the lentils, not because it's lentils, not because it's healthy, just because it's red. The red is the characteristic that's obvious on the surface. And that's all he's interested in, the immediate reaction, that's all. Meaning, he'll never do something for the benefits he can get tomorrow. If he can't get the benefits now, he doesn't care. That is the nature of Esav. Amalek has these characteristics and multiplied, of course. Because of the danger of becoming an Amalek, Yisro decides that he can't remain neutral. That's what the Mefarshim say. When Rashi says, Mashmu Shoma Uvo, he's not saying what made an impression on Yisro. Everything made an impression of Yisro. But why did he decide that he can't stay home and remain a good Gentile? Because he realized that there is never a guarantee. Look what happened to Amalek. He's so close by. He also heard the same information. Look the insensitivity that a human being can come to. Therefore, he decided to join the Jewish people. This is why Yisro is the first Ger Tzedek. He's the first Ger Tzedek, the first man that decides to join the Jewish people because he decides that it's too dangerous to keep away from them.
Esav had a good side.
Yeah, it's a very good side. It's a very good side. As a matter of fact, it says that eventually, b'moisa Moshiach, the good side of Esav will change. The bad side of Esav will be uprooted completely, and the good side of Esav will join Klal Yisrael. Now, there is another very interesting thing that I saw in Rabbeinu Bechaya here that I found to be an enormous chiddush. I found it a novelty, really. You know that there is a question here about the chronology. When did it really happen? When did the story of Yisro really happen? When did it come? Rashi mentions it later on. There is a question whether Yisro came before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah. When did it come with Moshe Rabbeinu's wife and his two sons? So, Rashi says, well, you know, that it could be either way, right? We don't know. It's an argument. It can be either way. But there is a big question, says Rabbeinu Bechaye, if it's true that Yisro came after Matan Torah, so why is he mentioned in the Torah before Matan Torah? So Rashi's answer is, Ein mukdom ume'uchor batorah. We have a rule that the Torah does not follow chronological order. Okay? Doesn't follow chronological order, meaning that things that happen in the Torah, what the Torah says first and says second, does, as far as the chronology is concerned, doesn't mean absolutely anything, because ein mukdom ume'uchor betorah. The Torah will not pay attention to the chronological order at all. But that just takes away the question. In other words, you can't prove that Yisro came before Matan Torah, because in the Torah there is no order. But then the question remains, but the if there is no chronological order, there must be another reason for the order. You follow the question of Rabbeinu Bechaye, which means, fine, granted, there is no chronological order in the Torah. Which means that Torah will put something first, not because it happened first, but there must be another reason why the Torah would write it first. This is what Rabbeinu Bechaye says. So what is the reason, according to the Man De'Omar, according to the opinion that says that Yisro came with Moshe's wife and children after Matan Torah, why is it mentioned before Matan Torah? Says Rabbeinu Bechaye like this. You know that it says that when Yoshua, what Yoshua did against Amalek was, if you remember the words used in the Pasuk itself, it says like this. In verse number 13 of the last week's portion and the last few words, the last four verses. Vayachalosh Yehoshua es Amalek vesamoy lefi chorev. Vayachalosh. The word vayachalosh means, and he weakened, he made them weaker, he made Amalek weaker. Vayachalosh. You see that? In Vayachalosh, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayachalosh. He made them weaker. Says Rashi, Veloy horgom kulo. Why didn't he kill them all? Yoshua could have destroyed them completely. Mikan onu lemeidim, says Rashi. From here we learn out. She also al pi hadibur shel shchina. We have no other answer why Yahushua didn't destroy them, except that Hashem said it's not the time yet. You only make them weaker, but it's not the time yet to destroy them completely. Why? Because we know that the complete destruction of Amalek, that means the coming of the Messiah. Right? In other words, the destruction of Amalek is tantamount to bringing the Messiah. So therefore, since the time wasn't right for the final redemption, therefore, of course, Amalek can't be completely destroyed. On the other hand, it's important to weaken Amalek, because if Amalek is too strong, then we don't stand a chance. So what Yeshua did was to take a first step towards the final redemption. That's what he did. But he did not actually carry out the complete destruction of Amalek, because the time wasn't right for the final redemption. Okay? Now. Yeah? Now. Obviously, what will give us the capacity eventually to destroy Amalek is Yehoshua's partial victory. Right? That is with the principle of Maasei Avos, Sima Lebanim. In other words, we draw our strength from something that happened in the Torah. As a matter of fact, who is going to be the one that will be the leader in that fight against Amalek? That's part, according to many Mefoshim, of Moshiach ben Yosef, which is really Moshiach ben Ephraim, which is Yehoshua ben Nun, Peshevet Ephraim. Now, Yehoshua ben Nun established that pattern, that it has to be a descendant of Yosef that will destroy Amalek. Okay? Now, after the destruction of the final Amalek, the real destruction of Amalek, then Yisro, who was the Ger Tzedek par excellence, is the Ger Tzedek, the one that comes from far away to join the Jewish people for no other reason because he recognizes the truth. Right? That is establishing the pattern that after the eventual destruction of Amalek, the whole world, says Rabbeinu Bechaye, will convert to Judaism. That's what he says. After the final destruction of Amalek, the whole world will accept our Torah. Now, yeah? The question,
I thought once the book is closed, so to speak, Goyim cannot convert.
All right, so I'm telling you like this. The truth of the matter is there is an open verse in Sefer Micho, one of the Trei Osser, in Sefer Micho, when it describes the Emos HaMashiach, it says, and all the nations will come with their gods, and we will come with our God. Right? That's what Micho... Yeah.
Now and then you see some mentioning of Mashiach, like a reason to this argument I would like to mention, because I don't know who is right. Now then you see that someone, this Mashiach, was born, but they stayed in and all that. How you can...
Well, there is a Pikabole, there is a Mashiach in every generation. There is a Pikabole, every generation has its own Mashiach, because there has to be a prepared Mashiach. Because we believe that we can bring Mashiach anytime we want, we decide. Meaning, there are two types of Mashiach. There is Be'ito, which means a specific time that he can't come any later than that, right? But there is another type of bringing Mashiach, which is Achishenu, which is we can bring him whenever we want to. Like according to one version, it says if you keep two Shabbosim, whatever.
Is that? Or when the critical mass of Jews come to this land.
Okay, so therefore there has to be a Mashiach ready to take over. Right? You know, because without it, I mean, if we would have to wait until he's born and he grows up, so you know, then it wouldn't be true that we can bring Mashiach. Right? Al pi Kabbalah, you can bring Mashiach any time Klal Yisrael as a whole decides. So there has to be somebody ready. They said this way Al pi Kabbalah.
No, it doesn't fit, because it starts reminding God forbid, many gods, many Mashiachs. Looks to me a bit similar to that somehow.
That one? Why?
Because Mashiach, as I understand it, appearance should be noticed immediately. Otherwise, why not believe God forbid Yeshua? But they also claim it's Mashiach. My argument is
the only proof that Yeshua was not Mashiach is, like the Rambam says, you know what's the proof that he was not Mashiach?
Killed.
Because he was killed, he wasn't successful, that's all. Now, the proof of Mashiach is if he's successful. That's the proof, that's all.
But everyone should recognize him. He's just a single
person. Only if he's successful, right? Take a look. In the chapter before last of Rambam, Hilchos Melochim, the last Rambam, the chapter before last, he says, Mashiach doesn't have to do any miracles. If a man gets up and he says, I am going to set up a Torah system, right, and bring truth to the world, and Torah, and God, and I'll make everybody God-fearing, then if he's successful, he's Mashiach. And if he's not successful, he's not Mashiach. Which means, the proof that Mashiach is false is when he's not successful. That's the proof.
Isn't the book open until Ben David is revealed? So all the way through the end of Gog and Magog, it's still a chance to become Gerim and become to do tshuva.
But who?
The deadline for doing tshuva, becoming a Ger, isn't that when Ben David is revealed?
Or
so throughout the period of Ben Yosef,
could be still that
you can still do tshuva.
Right. So the point is like this. So from here, from Rabbeinu Bechaya, you see the following. You see that there is a period, there is a messianic era, right? And in that messianic era, it's still during the fight. In other words, Amalek is not completely destroyed, but it's already called the messianic era. And during that era, there is already a recognition of all the nations of Hashem, but without any conversion to Torah. Right? That is what Micho, in Sefer Micho, it says that each nation will go with their gods. Right? That's before the final destruction of Amalek. This is how the Rabbeinu Bechaya master. But after the destruction of Amalek, you have destroyed, it's like the Gemara says, you have unified God's name, right? You have clarified, Bayom Ahu Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. So once you come to Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, there is no room for any other God. And the destruction of the Amalek means no room for any other God. So obviously there is nothing else but a mass conversion to Torah, okay? It's a novelty. It's not something usually the posuk, the verse in Micha is quoted. That Yemosa Mashiach does not mean mass conversion, right? From Rabbeinu Bechaya, you see, not like that. Rabbeinu Bechaya says that Yisro represents Maase Ovo Simen Lebonim, something that will happen after the final destruction of Amalek. That Yisro represents the pattern that all Gentiles will see. The crossing of the Red Sea, in other words, the Geulo, and Mechias Amalek, and they will all accept Torah. Yeah.
Doesn't that mean they could just keep the seven Noahide laws?
No, it says clearly, Doseinu, they'll accept the Torah. They'll accept the Torah. I mean, take a look. I mean, maybe you can say a different interpretation, Rabbeinu Bechaya, but I'm telling you, he says that everybody, like, there'll be a mass conversion. And that's why he mentions Israel, because...
Mentioning of Jews who belong to all kind of this reform and all that.
Again?
Would they recognize Torah also? I mean, all kind of liberals and reform and sanitation.
There will be no room for anything else. That's what we believe. Yeah.
You mentioned that Yisro was the first Ger Tzedek. Now, isn't that enough raya to say that it happened after Matan Torah? Because before Matan Torah...
No. He stayed there until after Matan Torah. That's for sure. Like Rashi says, he's for sure stayed there till after Matan Torah. The question is, when did he come? Right?
Well, when did he accept to become a Jew? Before or after?
When did he accept? Well, I guess after.
So that would make him the first.
But even before, I mean, still the first. I mean, he's the one that chooses on his own to come and join.
What about the Erev Rav?
Well, the Erev Rav wasn't a Geret Tzedek.
He was just running away.
It's not only that. You stick to the winner. It's not like a choice. Like, why should you stick to the loser, stick to the winner? I mean, it's either Mitzrayim or Israel, so why not join Israel? But it wasn't a real Ger Tzedek.
Were they all the people that came out of the dungeons and the jails, or just plain Egyptian
it's
citizens?
It's hard to know exactly who the Erev Rav were. It's very, very difficult to know who they were and what they were.
Why were they allowed to go with the Jews, though? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu allow them to go, though?
That's a big question, but that's a different subject. It's a very big question. Why Moshe Rabbeinu allowed them, and we find that Hashem keeps telling him, you are the one who brought it. It's as if, like, you didn't ask me permission, which is, again, very difficult to understand. But it sounds like Moshe Rabbeinu brought them on his own. But that's a different question. Okay, now. In Posuk Ches, Vaisaper Moshe Lechosno, he come and he meets Moshe Rabbeinu, Vaisaper Moshe Lechosno, Es Kol Asher Asu Hashem Lefaroi Umitzray, Aloi Doish Yisrael, and Moshe Rabbeinu tells his father-in-law, everything that God did to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians, Aloi Doish Yisrael, Es Kol Hatlo O Asher Mitzo Osam Baderech Vayitzilem Hashem. All the nisim. Moshe Rabbeinu tells his father-in-law all the nisim. The question here is an open question. Why does Moshe have to tell over Yisrael everything that happened when according to the simple interpretation, and Rashi says so in verse number 1, what does it say? That he heard about it. So why does Moshe have to tell it over to him again? So that it says in the Mephorshim. I'll tell you the answer right away. We'll go to the next to Psukim, and we'll see the other question. Vayichad Yisroel. The word Vayichad, Rashi says that Vayichad is Vayismach. But it means more than that. The word Vayichad comes from the word Echod, Leyachei, to identify. He identified with the Jews so strongly, Asher Oso Hashem Leisro, Asher Yitzhidam Ad Mitzrayim, Vayomer Yisro, that Yisro says, Baruch Hashem. From here we learn now, that you have to say Baruch Hashem, you have to make a bracha for good news, right? Somebody tells you good news, you have to make a bracha. Baruch Hashem, Asher Hitzil Eschem Yad Mitzrayim Yad Paroi, Asher Hitzil Esom Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. Baruch Hashem, he makes a bracha. And as a matter of fact, we do learn it out, that the bracha from Yisrael is the bracha Allah Tovotu, on good news. The question is, why did he make the bracha now? Why didn't he make the bracha on Vayishma Yisrael whenever he heard it? And if he made it already, it's a bracha levatole. To make it twice is a bracha levatole.
He wasn't a Jew then?
What?
He didn't consider himself Jewish then?
So, I don't understand. So, doesn't matter. First of all, at this point, he's not Jewish either, right? We are just learning it out from the Gentile, right? He didn't yet accept, or as far as we know, he didn't yet accept the Torah yet. And even if yes, but it does say that at this point he made a bracha. But the good news came before. Why does it, you know, it's too late now. What do you mean it's a bracha to himself? When nobody's around, somebody tells you good news, you say, Baruch Shechiyonu Vekimonu Vegiyonu Lezman Hazeh. So I saw in the Mayonah Shel Torah, it says like this. Or, yeah. Or maybe I said another sefer, but anyway, it says like this. You know, when Moshe Rabbeinu tells over something, right? It's not as if you are reading the story from a book. When Moshe Rabbeinu tells you what happened to him, the intensity of the experience is relived. Right? That's the koyach of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? He can relive the intensity of his experience. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu can say over a nevuah, and you feel it's a nevuah. That means the experience that Moshe Rabbeinu had, he can transfer it to someone else, to the listener. That's the koyach of Moshe Rabbeinu, is the Novi. Right? He can transfer his own experiences. Now, until Moshe Rabbeinu told over Yisroel the story, so it was a story. He heard it. He heard it on the radio. He heard it. They read it in the paper. It doesn't matter, which means it's information that is received secondhand. Right? How did he hear about the crossing of the Red Sea? One person told some other person, and that person told somebody else, until he got to the ears of Yisroel. That's cold information that by the time it reaches Yisroel, he can think about it objectively and make a decision. When Moshe Rabbeinu tells Yisroel about the crossing of the Red Sea, when he tells him about the 10 plagues, when he tells him exactly everything that happened to Paro, he's reliving the experience. And that's the broche. The broche is Vayichad Yisroel. When he heard it from Moshe Rabbeinu, he identified with what happened with such an intensity that this is why he makes the broche. It's as if it happened to him. Like this is something that happened to somebody else. Why do I have to make the broche? But when you hear it from Moshe Rabbeinu, it's such a Vayichad. You identify so strongly that that's why he makes the broche.
Is that to say, so far as... Could one go so far as to say that he could even make the bracha again?
Definitely, because it's the first time. Not again. There is no again. You know, it's, even though he heard it again, this is the first time he feels the experience. Up to now, it was information. Now it becomes an experience that he lives through it.
So we're saying that he didn't make the bracha the first time, but
for sure not. For sure not. This is the first time. Because the first time it was information. Information that came to his ear. He heard it. He judged it. Right? Sure. That's it. There was no living through the experience. When Moshe Rabbeinu tells him over, he lives through the experience. Now, in Pasuk Yud Gimel,
well, this is, yeah, is after Matan Torah conversation.
No. That's before Matan Torah. That's before Matan Torah. I'll tell you right away. I mean, according to Man De'Omar, it happened before Matan Torah. Because take a look here in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayimi Mocharos. And it was the next day. Now, which next day of what? Vayimi Mocharos. It says like this. Vayeshev Moshe Lishpot Esa'om. And Moshe sat down to judge the people. Vayamod Ha'om Al Moshe Min HaBoker Ad Ha'orev. So, what does it say? That next day Moshe sat down and judged the people. And what about the day before he didn't judge the people? So you must say, well, it means that Yisro saw it. It's not true. Because that Yisro saw it, it says in Pasuk 14, Vayarchos en Moshe. So in Pasuk 13, it's not describing what Yisro saw. In Pasuk 13, it's describing the facts that Moshe, the day after, sat down to judge the people. So the incredible question is, so what happened up to the next day? Right? What happened before the next day? Says Rashi, that's not the next day of his arrival. It's the next day after the receiving of the Torah. When was the Torah received? Finally. Not the first time around. The final receiving of the Torah. Which day was it?
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur. Right? The final receiving of the Torah is Yom Kippur. Right? What happened the first time around? The Jews heard the Aseres HaDibros. Right after the Aseres HaDibros, Moshe disappears. Right? He disappears for 40 days. When he comes down again, he finds the golden calf. Right? Then he waits until Hashem gives him a second chance. When is he told that he's given a second chance? Rosh Chodesh Elul. Right? So he goes up to Sinai in Rosh Chodesh Elul and he stays for 40 days. And it's only a Yom Kippur that he hears Vayomer Hashem Solachti, that Hashem says, I've forgiven the Jewish people for the sin of the golden calf. Which comes out that when is the first time that the Jews are judged according to the laws of the Torah? When is the first day that the laws of the Torah apply to all Jews? The day after Yom Kippur. Before Yom Kippur, there is no laws of the Torah. Right? They know the Ten Commandments. They know a few other laws, but there is no system of laws. The system of laws of the Torah, right, are first used the day after Yom Kippur. That's Vayimi Mocharos. So Vayeshev Moshe Lishpoit Esa'om means the first time around that Moshe Rabbeinu sits down to make decisions to the people. Now, and then it says like this, Vayamod Ha'om Al Moshe, and the people stood by Moshe min HaBoker Ad Ha'orev, from the morning until the evening. Says Rashi, what does it mean, min HaBoker Ad Ha'orev? So on the surface, nothing difficult. Boker Ad Ha'orev, from the morning until the evening, and then in the evening Moshe went to sleep or whatever. But during the whole day, they just stood there waiting in line to get their turn. That's what it seems on the surface. Says Rashi, that's not what it means. Says Rashi, min HaBoker Ad Ha'orev, that's the last Rashi in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Evshalomar came. Is it possible to say that Moshe Rabbeinu spent a whole day, right, letting people wait in line to make decisions? Elo, it means something else. Kol Dayon Shedon Din Emes Lamito, a judge that judges correctly, afilu Shoachas, even if his decision takes a minute. Shoachas doesn't mean necessarily an hour. It means even a short period of time. Male olov hakosu, that would be the same kilu osek betoro, as if he's involved in Torah kol hayom. Ukeilu nase shutev lakodosh baruch hu b'maseh breishit, it's as if he becomes a partner with God in the creation of the world. Shenemar vayere vayboiker, You see, min boiker ad erev, right? And the world was created by erev by boiker, so therefore you see that Moshe Rabbeinu was becoming the partner of Hashem in the creation of the world. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? And in simple pshat, it makes no sense at all what Rashi is saying. Because according to Rashi's pshat, there is no proof in the Torah that Moshe spent a long time judging people. Right? According to Rashi, it may have maybe took him a half hour a day. Maybe. An hour a day. So if so, what does it make sense? What is Yisro saying to Moshe? You won't be able to take it. You're working too long. You're working too much. You're working an hour a day. He said, if you learn simple pshat, that Moshe Rabbeinu worked day and night, then you can understand Yisro's criticism. You are working too hard. You won't be able to keep it up. But if you're learning Rashi's pshat, that min haboker ad ha'arev only tells you it's just a hint to the truthfulness of Moshe Rabbeinu's psak, how reliable his psak is, right? Meaning that's why it says min haboker ad ha'arev, that even though it may have taken him 1 minute, but that 1 minute by Moshe Rabbeinu, it's as if he stands and learns for a whole day. So if so, how long is Moshe Rabbeinu working? Maybe a minute, maybe an hour. If so, we can't understand the criticism of Yisro. You hear the question? Now, according to Rashi's interpretation, the pasuk doesn't make any sense at all. Pshat in Rashi is like this. What does it mean that the Torah expresses the idea, listen to this, a judge who judges emes le'amito, it's as if he stands a whole day in his Oseg B'Torah. What is the analogy? Say, if somebody passes emes le'amito, he's a great person. But what does it mean? That it's as if he's involved a whole day in Torah. What is the analogy? There has to be an analogy, right? Pshat in the analogy is the following. What is din emes le'amito? How does emes differ from emes le'amito? Right? There is emes and there is emes le'amito. There is truth and there is real truth. I mean, what is truth and what's real truth? Truth alone is not real truth, so what is it? Non-truth. The point is like this. It says that there are two ways that you can be a judge, right? You hear the situation. You're a judge. You hear the situation, right? The man comes and says, well, the other person borrowed from me a pencil and he never gave it back to me. Or he borrowed from me a plate and he never gave it back to me, right? And I want him to swear, right? So the judge will look in the Shulchan Aruch or remember the Shulchan Aruch by heart and say, what is the law? Somebody borrows something. And okay, so now he has to swear, blah, blah, blah. That's it. He makes a decision. Okay, pay. That's it. End of case. But there is another way that you can judge. You can say, wait a second. If he borrowed a plate, that means that he has no other plate, that he has a problem. How is he going to eat? Right. So then I have to become involved in finding out what's wrong with the person that didn't have a plate. Maybe he's missing plates. If he's missing plates, that means that he has no money to buy plates. Maybe if he has no money to buy plates, maybe he needs food. In other words, all of a sudden, the decision-making process becomes part of us, a whole idea of caring for the people involved, right? It becomes a basis for really becoming involved in what's happening to both sides, right? Meaning, you come with a certain question. Then that gives, it's like, they tell over this story that somebody came to Reb Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, the Achiez in Vilna, the Vilna Rav, the Vilna Rabbi. They came before Passover and they asked him a question in Halacha. Are you Yotze? Can you fulfill the obligation of Arba Kosos with milk? Right? A simple question. Right? So what should a regular rabbi do? Take a look in Shulchan Aruch. Either decide if milk is considered a drink or it's not considered a drink. That's all. What did Reb Chaim Ozer say? He called right away the man in charge of the charity. And he says, if the man asks whether he can use milk for Arba Kosos, that proves one thing. it doesn't have any meat to eat for the Seder. So a man who has no meat or chicken for the Seder has to be taken care of. Please take care of it. You understand? That's the difference of someone who paskins emes. Reb Chaim Moser could have said emes. Either yes or no would be the emes, whatever Reb Chaim Moser says. But he doesn't care about emes. He cares about emes lamito. Emes lamito means where the emes leads you to. Right? So that means that Moshe Rabbeinu became involved with every issue. So that means that he's worried, that his thinking went along with the person, not only when he paskins, not only when he makes a decision. Every second of the day, his mind was with that person who asked him the question. So that kind of an involvement, Yisro saw, is impossible. It's not a system. It's not a system. A system has to be something that you don't become emotionally involved. Moshe Rabbeinu is looking for emes lamito. You can't have a system looking for emes lamito. You can have people, individuals. A system has to follow emes. Anshei emes. You can't have emes lamito. And that's exactly what Yisro says. You don't need emes lamito. What do you need, he says, in Pasuk Chovbet, in Pasuk Chovalet, Anshei emes. All you have to do is emes, not Anshei emes lamito. So you hear, what is the difference between emes lamito and emes? Emes lamito means that you go beyond the issues. You go to the people and you don't, you're not concerned with issues. This is how Rashi understood the Pasuk, right? Remember, we asked the question, what is the criticism of Yisro? If mina boiker ad orev just means that for a half hour a day, he made true judgments. So, what is the criticism of Yisro? The criticism of Yisro is that you become so involved with the people. That can be a system. That can go on. It can become a system. Now,
isn't it preferable, though?
What?
Isn't it preferable?
Just wait. Let's just want to go on a little bit more. Now, so what does Yisro tell him? We must set up a system. What is the system? So he tells him the system that you should choose people with this and this qualities. And that you should make a system based on a pyramid, which means from every 10 people, choose one who is the most capable one of being the judge. And then, if it's necessary, they should be, from every 100 people, one that should be in charge, and from every 1,000 people, right? And in case the case becomes too difficult, too complicated, they'll go to you directly. And Moshe Rabbeinu, with a few changes, we won't have the time today to point out the changes, but Blineter tomorrow, on Tuesday. But the idea is accepted by Moshe Rabbeinu. He accepts the idea of the system. The question is, if it's such a good idea what Yisro gave, why do we need Yisro for? Right. Either Hashem himself should have said it to Moshe, or Moshe should have thought about it. And Eloma, what are you going to say? No, the idea is not so good. If it is not so good, so how come we did accept it? Either way, we are stuck. If the idea is good, why couldn't we think of it? If the idea is not good, so why was it accepted? The answer, of course, lies in the fact that the whole idea of a judicial system, that's what Yisro is setting up, a judicial system, a system of justice, goes against the ideal of pure Torah. Pure Torah is against a judicial system. So what kind of a system should we have? So there's a So I'm going to give a perfect example. What kind of arguments should Jews have? You know, there was a story, a real story that happened in Europe. Somebody bought a field from a friend, from somebody else. And he was going to build a little house on that field. And all of a sudden, he hits something hard, and he takes out a box. And he opens the box, and it's full of jewels and coins, gold coins, silver coins. He goes right away to the seller, and he tells him, you know, since that wasn't part of our contract, the box belongs to you. So the seller says, no, it doesn't belong to me either, because I was never aware that it was there. So that means that I never had kavod, I never had any intention, I never thought about the box. So therefore, when I was never, therefore, it's 100% yours. And the other man says, no, but I won't keep it. I mean, because when I bought it, I never had in mind to buy the box. So they come to the rabbi to have an argument whether he is right or he is right. That's the type of an argument that you should have and go to the rabbis too. But there's an enormous difference, you see. When you go to a judge to find out who is right, you are not going to a judicial system. You are going to the an educational system. You know, it's the essence of the perfect system is an educational system. Educational system means that you go to find out from the Rebbe who is right, what's closer to the truth. That's the idea. So, who is the perfect Rebbe? Who is the Rebbe of all Rebbes? The Rebbe, the quintessential Rebbe. Moshe Rabbeinu, the only one that's called Rabbeinu. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu. So, Moshe Rabbeinu, the system of Moshe Rabbeinu, it's not a system. Is that everybody wants to do what's right. So, of course, you go to the source of what's right, the source of truth, Moshe Rabbeinu. If Jews would have been able to remain in a perfect state, completely isolated from the world, they could have maintained that level, and that level would have been the ideal level. Right? You have no judicial system, because you only need a judicial system when people become corrupt. If people want to do what's right, why do you need a judicial system? All you need are rabbis telling you what's right and what's wrong. What do you need judges for? The whole idea of judges expresses the fact that we are in a corrupt society, that each one wants something for himself. Therefore, there are arguments that why do you need judges? You need judges in a perfect society, in a society when everybody's God-fearing, everybody wants to do what's right. All you need is people telling you what's right. All you need is a Moshe Rabbeinu, that's all. So if so, what are we saying then? That Yisro's idea was not such a good idea at all. It goes against the pure Torah. Pure Torah has to be from Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu saying the truth. That is Torah. Not saying who is right. Saying what's the truth, not who is right. So now the question is turned around. So if it's such a bad idea, so how come it was accepted? And the answer lies in the fact that we are not isolated from the Gentiles. We live in a society, we live in a world, and in that world there are people, and those people have values and they have a system. And as long as you live in this world, you can't isolate yourself completely. Most you can do is to limit, control what you absorb from them, and then give it a Torah twist. Like Rambam says in Moira Nevuchim concerning korbonos, concerning sacrifices. He says, what do you need sacrifices for? Right? Prayer should be enough. What do you need sacrifices? So he says, in that ancient world where the Jews lived, living without bringing sacrifices was impossible to comprehend. I mean, it's hard for us to understand it. But you live in a society that whatever you believe in, you worship. How do you worship? By offering. It would be incredible, unheard of, incomprehensible to believe in something and not offer. It's incomprehensible. It's not possible to understand such a thing. So what can Torah do? Torah is forced to accept the fact that people have to bring korbanos. But what does the Torah do? It controls it. It limits it. Only in a certain place, only at certain times, only certain animals, only the Kohanim are allowed to do it, only this, or that. In other words, with so many restrictions, we Torahize. In other words, we give it a Torah twist. We take the values that we absorb, unfortunately, from the world around us, and we give it a Torah taste. So the same idea with Avdu, slavery. The whole concept of slavery is against Torah. The whole idea in Torah is kovod ha'odom, respect for the human being, betzalem elokim bara ha'odom. How all of a sudden the idea of kovod ha'brios, respect for the human being, how does it fit with the idea of slavery? That you treat a person like an animal, right? The answer is that slavery was a way of life in every society. Forget about what you know, today, right? Until a few hundred years ago, it was impossible to comprehend. What do you mean you live without slaves? It's like saying, all of a sudden, let's do away with money. I mean, you just don't do away with money. You live with money. That's part of the system. So what did Torah do? It took a system that was in existence. And because it was in existence, it became part of Klal Yisrael. But Klal Yisrael gave it a Torah twist. What is a Torah twist? Okay, you buy a slave, you bought it, it's yours. But you know what? You know you have to circumcise him? You know what? You have to teach him all negative commandments? You hear how much time you have to spend with your slave? Teach him all negative commandments. Make sure he doesn't work on the Sabbath. Make sure he eats kosher food, right? You hear? If you're a Kohen and you have a slave, he can eat truma. You hear, your neighbor, the Levi, can't eat truma, but your slave can eat truma. What is the Torah doing? The Torah took a fact of life, slavery, and it humanized.